This is Jorge Luis Borges at Harvard University in 1968.
Remember, the Gnostics said that the only way to be rid of a sin was to commit it, because afterwards you repented. And I think that as regards literature, they were essentially right. For if I have attained to the happiness of writing 4 or 5 tolerable pages after writing 15 tolerable volumes, I have come to that feat not only through the many years, but also through the method of trial and error. I think I have committed not all the possible mistakes, because mistakes are innumerable, but many of them. For example, I began, as most young men do, by thinking that free verse is easier than the regular forms of verse. I am quite sure in thinking that free verse is far more difficult than the regular, than the classic forms. And the proof is, if a proof be needed, that literature begins by verse. I suppose the explanation would be that once a pattern is evolved, a pattern, for example, of rhymes, of assonances, of alliterations, of long and short syllables, and so on, you only have to repeat the pattern. While if you attempt prose, and prose, of course, comes long after verse, then you need, as Stevenson pointed out, a more subtle pattern, because the ear is led to expect something, and then it does not get what it expects, but something else is given to it, and that something else should be, in a sense, a failure and also a satisfaction. And so what I should say, that unless you take the precaution of being Walt Whitman or Carl Sandburg, then free verse is more difficult. At least I have found, now when I'm near my journey's end, that the classic forms of verse are easier. And another facility, another easiness, may lie in the fact that once you have written a certain line, that once you have resigned yourself to a certain line, then you have committed yourself to a certain rhyme. And as rhymes are not infinite, then your work is made easier for you. Of course, what is important is what is behind the verse. I began by trying, as all young men do, I began by trying to disguise myself. At first, I was so mistaken that at the time when I read Carlyle and Whitman, I thought that Carlyle's way of writing prose was the only possible one, and that Whitman's way of writing verse was the only possible one. And I made no attempt whatever to reconcile this very strange fact of having two opposite men having attained the perfections of prose and of verse. When I began writing, I always said to myself that my ideas were very shallow, that if a reader saw through them, he would despise me. And so I disguised myself. I disguised myself. In the beginning, I tried to be a 17th century Spanish writer with a certain knowledge of Latin. My knowledge of Latin was quite slight. I do not think of myself now as a 17th century Spanish writer. And my attempts to be Sir Thomas Browne in Spanish failed utterly. Oh, perhaps I evolved quite a dozen fine-sounding lines. Of course, I was out for purple patches. Now I think that purple patches are a mistake. I think they are a mistake because they're a sign of vanity. And so the reader thinks of him as being science of vanity. And if the reader thinks of you and he thinks that you have a moral defect, there is no reason whatever why he should admire you or put up with you. Then I fell into a very common mistake. I did my best to be, of all things, modern.
This is a program of experimental dance, pop, musics, as well as lectures about thought, writing, and life. This is killradio.org in Los Angeles, reaching out on a magical night, trying to use all the powers at my command, the mad magician, puppeteer, master puppeteer that I am here. Welcome to the chill room.
I'm your advisor, make your drunk stay. At your feet, to convince you of your pain. And you run to me, and you start to get so homesick.
There is a character in Goethe's, Wilhelm Meister's Lehrjahre. The character says, well, you may say of me what you like, but nobody will deny that I am a contemporary. Now, I see no difference whatever between that quite absurd character in Goethe's novel and the wish to be modern, because we are modern. We don't have to strive to be modern. It is not a case of subject matter, of style. I suppose that if you look into Sir Walter Scott's Ivanhoe, or to take a rather different example into Flaubert's Salammbô, You may tell the date when those books were written. Though Flaubert spoke of Salammbô as a roman cartaginois, any reader worth his salt would know, after reading the first page, that the book was not written in Carthage, but that it was written by a very intelligent Frenchman of the 19th century. And as to Ivanhoe, we are not taken in by the castles and the knights and the Saxon swineherd and so on. We know all the time that we are reading an 18th or 19th century author. Besides, we are modern by the very simple fact that we live in the present. Nobody has discovered as yet the art of living in the past, and not even the futurists have discovered the secret of living in the future. We are modern, whether we want it or not, and perhaps the very fact of my attacking modernity now is in its way, I suppose, a way of being modern also. When I began writing stories, I did my best to trick them out. I labored over the style. Sometimes they were hidden under the many overlayings. For example, I thought of a quite good plot. Then I wrote the story El Immortal. Now, the idea behind that story, and the idea will come as a surprise to any of you who have read the story, is the idea that if a man were immortal, then in the long run, and the run would be long, of course, since it would be endless, then in the long run, he would have said all things, done all things, written all things. And then I took as my example Homer. I thought of Homer, if indeed he existed, as having written his Iliad. Then Homer would go on living. And then he would change as the generations of men have changed. And then, of course, he would forget his Greek. In due time, he would forget that he had been Homer. And a moment might come when he would think of Pope's translation of Homer as being not only a fine work of art, indeed it is, but as being true to the original. But that idea of Homer forgetting that he was Homer, that idea is hidden under the many structures I wove around the book. And indeed, when I reread that story a couple of years ago, I found it a weariness of the flesh, and I had to go back to my old plan to see that the story would have been quite good had I been content to write it down simply and not to permit so many purple patches and so many strange adjectives and metaphors. Now, I think I've come not to a certain wisdom, but perhaps to a certain sense. I think of myself as a writer. And what does being a writer mean to me? It means simply being true to my imagination. That is to say, when I write something, I do not think of it as being true to fact, to mere fact, since mere fact, after all, is a web of circumstances and axioms, but of being true to something deeper. That is to say, when I write a story, I write it because somehow I believe in it, not as one believes in mere history, or as one believes in a dream or in an idea, or in an idea. And I think that perhaps you are led astray by one of the studies I value most, the study of the history of literature. I wonder, and I hope this is not a blasphemy, I wonder if you are not too aware of history. Because being aware of the history of literature, or of any other art for that matter, is really a form of unbelieving, a form of skepticism. If I say to myself, for example, that Wordsworth or Verlaine were very good 19th century poets, then I may fall into the danger of thinking that time somehow has destroyed them, that they are not as good now as they were. And yet, I think the ancient idea was a braver one, the idea that perfection might be allowed to art without taking into account the dates. I have read several histories of Indian philosophy, and the authors, Englishmen, Germans, Frenchmen, Americans, and so on, always wonder at the fact that that in India people have no historical sense, that they treat all thinkers as if they were contemporary, that they translate the words of an ancient philosophy into the, let us say, the modern jargon of today, philosophy. But this stands for something brave. This stands for the idea that one believes in philosophy, or one believes in poetry, that things beautiful once can go on being beautiful still. And though I suppose I'm being quite historic when I say this, since of course the meanings of words are changing, the connotations of words are changing, it's still, I think, that there are verses in Virgil, for example, I wonder if I'm scanning it as I should, because my Latin is very rusty. For example, I suppose that when Virgil wrote Ibant obscuri, sola sub nocte, per umbram, or that when an old English poet wrote Northans nude, and so on, or when we read, for example, music to hear, why hear is our music sadly, sweets with sweets war not, joy delights in joy, I think that somehow we are beyond time. I think that there is an eternity in beauty. And this, of course, is what Keats had in mind when he wrote, a thing of beauty is a joy forever. We accept this verse, but you accept it somehow as a kind of right, as a kind of formula. And yet, sometimes I am, well, courageous and hopeful enough, to think that it may be true, that though men write in time, though all men are involved in the circumstances and actions and failures of time, somehow things of eternal beauty may be achieved. When I write, I try, as I have said, to be loyal to the dream, not of being loyal to circumstances. Of course, in my stories, people tell me I should speak about them, in my story there are true circumstances. But somehow I have felt that those circumstances should always be told with a certain amount of untruth. I think there is no satisfaction in telling a story as it actually happened. We have to change things, even if we think them insignificant. If not, we should not think of ourselves as artists, but perhaps as mere journalists or mere historians. Though I suppose all true historians have known that they can be quite as imaginative as novelists. For example, when we read Gibbon, I suppose the pleasure we get from Gibbon is quite akin to the pleasure we get from reading a great novelist. After all, he knew very little about his characters. I suppose he had to imagine the circumstances. I suppose he must have thought of himself as having created, in a sense, the decline and fall of the Roman Empire. And he did it so wonderfully that I do not care to accept any other explanation. So that, had I to give advice, the writers, and I do not think they need it, because everyone has to find all things by himself, I would give them simply this one. I would ask them to tamper as little as they can with their own work. I do not think tinkering is any good. I think that the moment comes when one has found out what one can do, when one has found out one's natural voice, one's rhythm. And then I do not think slight emendations should prove useful. When I write, I think not of the reader, because the reader is, of course, an imaginary character. I do not think of myself. Perhaps I am an imaginary character also. I think of what I am trying to convey, and I do my best not to spoil it. When I was young, I believed in expression. I had read Croce, and the reading of Croce did me no good. I wanted to express everything. I thought, for example, that if I needed a sunset, then I should find the exact word for a sunset, or the exact, or rather the most surprising metaphor. And now I have come to a conclusion, and this conclusion may sound sad. The conclusion is that I no longer believe in expression. I only believe in allusion. Because after all, what are words? Words are symbols for shared memories. If I use a word, then you should have experience of what the word stands for. If not, the word means nothing to you. And I think you can only allude, you can only try to make the reader imagine. I think that the reader, if he is quick enough, can be satisfied with merely hinting at something. And this makes, I think, for efficiency, and in my own case, it also makes for laziness. I have been asked why I have never attempted a novel. Well, laziness, of course, is the first explanation, but there is another one. I have never read any novel without feeling a certain weariness. I think that novels include padding. I think that padding may be an essential part of the novel, for all I know. And yet, I have read many short stories over and over again. And I find, for example, that in a short story by Henry James or by Rudyard Kipling, you get quite as much complexity and in a more pleasurable way as you may get out of a long novel. And I think that this is what my creed comes to. When I promised a poet's creed, I thought very credulously that once I had given 5 lectures, I would be made by the fact of having given 5 lectures, I would evolve a creed of some kind. But I think I owe it to you to say that I know I have no particular creed, except those few precautions and misgivings I have been talking to you about. I try, when I'm writing something, I try not to understand it. I do not think intelligence has much to do with the work of a writer. I think that one of the sins of modern literature is the fact that it is too self-conscious. For example, I think of French literature as being one of the great literatures in the world. I don't suppose anybody could doubt that. And yet, I have been made to feel how the authors are generally too self-conscious. And suppose a French writer begins by defining himself before he quite knows what he is going to write. And so he says, what should, for example, a Catholic born in such and such a province and being a bit of a socialist write? Or how should we write after the Second World War? And I suppose there are many people all over the world who labor under those illusory problems. When I write, and of course I may not be a fair example, but merely an awful warning, when I write, I try to forget all about myself. I forget about my personal circumstances. I do not try, as I tried once, to be a South American writer. I merely try to convey what the dream is. And if the dream be a dim one, and in my case it generally is, I do not try to beautify it or even to understand it. And maybe I have done well, for every time I read an article about me, and somehow there seem to be quite a lot of people doing that sort of thing, I am generally amazed and very grateful for the deep meanings that I have read into quite haphazard jottings of mine. And of course, I am grateful to them, for I think of writing as being a kind of a collaboration. That is to say, the reader does his part of the word, of the work. He is enriching the book. And the same thing happens, I suppose, when one is lecturing. You may think that now and then I have given a good lecture. In that case, I have to congratulate you, because after all, you have been working with me. Had it not been for you, I don't think the lecture would have seemed particularly good or even tolerably. I hope that you have been collaborating with me tonight. And since this night is different from other nights, I would like to say something about myself. Because I came to America 6 months ago. In my country, I am practically, to repeat the title of a famous book by Wells, I am practically the invisible man. And here, I am somehow visible. Here, people have read me. They have read me so much that they cross-examine me on stories they have forgotten all about. They ask me, why did so-and-so, why so-and-so was silent before he answered? And then I wonder who so-and-so was, why he was silent, what he answered. Well, and then I hesitate to tell them the truth. I say that so-and-so was silent before he answered, because one generally is silent before one answers. And yet, all these things have made me happy. I think that you're quite mistaken if you admire, I wonder if you do, my writing. But I think of it as a very generous mistake. I think that one should try to believe in things, even if they let you down afterwards. And if I am joking now, I am joking, well, because I feel something within me. I am joking because I really feel what this means to me. I know that I shall look back on this night, that I shall wonder, why did not I say what I should have said? Why did not I say what these months in America have meant to me? What all these unknown friends have meant to me? But I suppose that somehow my feeling is coming through to you. I've been asked to say some verses of mine. I will go over a sonnet, the sonnet on Spinoza. The fact that many of you may have no Spanish will make it a finer sonnet, of course. And as I have said, that meaning is not important, that what is important is a certain music, a certain way of saying things. Maybe, though the music may not be there, you will feel it, or rather, since I know that you're very kind, you will invent it for me. Now we come on to the sonnet, Espinosa. Las traslúcidas manos del judío labran en la penumbra los cristales, y la tarde que muere, miedo y frío, las tardes a las tardes son iguales. Las manos y el espacio de Jacinto que palidece en el confín del gueto casi no existen para el hombre quieto que está soñando un claro laberinto. No lo turba la fama, ese reflejo de sueños en el sueño de otro espejo, ni el temeroso amor de las doncellas, libre de la metáfora y del mito, labrunardo cristal, el infinito, mapa de aquel que es todas sus estrellas.
Now, I want to read that in English. This is an English translation of that piece, Spinoza. The Jew's hands, translucent in the dusk, polish the lenses time and again. The dying afternoon is fear, is cold, and all afternoons are the same. The hands and the hyacinth blue air that whitens at the ghetto edges do not quite exist for this silent man who conjures up a clear labyrinth. Undisturbed by fame, that reflection of dreams in the dream of another mirror, nor by maidens' timid love. Free of metaphor and myth, he grinds a stubborn crystal, the infinite map of the one who is all his stars.